place to come back home to Mississippi. And I related this story to you, ladies and gentlemen, in May. Mississippi is my home. It was from Mississippi that I came. This afternoon, John and my mother and I visited a cemetery in Copiah County in Mississippi, right on Peggy Creek, right close to the Pearl River. While there, I pointed to a little piece of ground. I said, "John, this is where this old piece of clay is going to lay one day." We went and looked at my father's grave. Took one step up the row, another generation, we looked at my grandfather's grave. And then we went one other generation up, and we looked at my great-grandfather's tombstone. And there on that tombstone was written, "John Wesley Kennedy, Company F, 38th Mississippi, Confederate States of America." I'm proud of that man. I'm no different than any of the rest of you people here. We all are proud of our ancestors and what they did. But it's a pride that is really folded within the folds of humility. For we understand and we know that what our ancestors so nobly and courageously did, we are not responsible for. We are the recipients of all that they did. You know, it's no great honor to be the child of a great man. It's an honor to be a great man. So what we must learn to do, ladies and gentlemen, is learn how to emulate those great and noble deeds of our Confederate forefathers. For it's in that emulation of those deeds and those things which they are that our children's children can point back to us one day and say, "See, that is what we should be like." And that is what I want to talk to you a little bit tonight. We're going to talk about some heroes. I want to talk a little at first about the nature of the heroes that we look up to. And then I would like to get into what really I would call the text of my message this afternoon, and that is secession as taught at West Point. Secession as taught at West Point. What is a hero anyway? I looked it up in my dictionary, and according to what I understand from my dictionary, it comes from a root word in the Greek, which means to watch over or protect. It also means one of great courage and strength and favorite of the gods. In essence, that's what heroes are about. Our heroes are the ones who watch over the mythology of our people. Now, when I say mythology, I'm not talking about myth as in a lie or a falsehood. I'm talking about the stories that we are told, our cultural roots. Our heroes are the ones who guard over these things. Our heroes are the ones that we hold these little children up to and say, "Look, that's what we need to be like as a society and as a people." Heroes are very important, very important. As a matter of fact, if I want to know something about a nation, a culture, or a people, I don't go look at their roads, their parks, their buildings. I don't look at their infrastructure. I don't even look at their police force or their hospitals. That's not what I want to look at if I want to know what a people, a culture, or a nation is like. I look to their heroes. For if you'll show me a nation's heroes, I'll show you the true nature and spirit of those people. Because what they look up to is what they aspire to be. That's what these people are like. They look up to these people. Oh, you know, I can understand. I can see what their society is like. In the Union of the Soviet Socialist Republic, you know that Union that's supposed to be perpetual and last forever over in the Soviet Union, their heroes were these embalmed old dead bodies, Marx, Lenin, all those heroes that they had, just dead waxy corpses over there. But that was their heroes. They can't be their gods because they were officially atheists, but they had, that was their heroes. That was who they looked up to, as it were. Look at that society today. I would dare say that the one society in the world today that is hungering and thirsting after the gospel of the Lord Jesus Christ is not the United States. but the people over in Russia, in the former Soviet Union, the new republics of that old union that has gone away. They are thirsting, they are hungry, because for so long they have had no real heroes to look up to. Their gods have been deified. They've lost their deity. They're no longer gods. They have been proven to be nothing but mortal clay. They're not anything to look up to. They're wasted. They're gone. They're in retreat. These people now are looking for something else. Well, consider the heroes in America today. Who are the heroes of America? America, we have a strange lot and a strange set of heroes today. Our heroes are politically correct people, PC people, I call them. They're people who meet the criteria of the liberal masters of media, education, and yes, even religion. They have to be some certain type of person to be our hero. Who are our heroes? Well, think of Martin Luther King. That's a hero nowadays. A womanizer. A man who would steal his doctoral thesis. A man who was a fellow traveler with nothing but out-and-out communists. He's a hero today. That's the type of people that we as a society are pointing to and say, this is the type of man that we aspire to be. But even poor, poor Martin, he has to move over, because along comes Malcolm the Tenth. Or X, Malcolm X. Along come Malcolm X, and poor Martin Luther has to go to the back seat of the culturally correct bus and sit there. Because now our hero is a racist demagogue. You see his name and his mark. I really can't write. I really know what the X is about. You see his mark all over the place, on T-shirts, on caps. Also, you turn the TV on and you hear all these glowing reports about this man who was the most vile and cruel racist demagogue, hate monger, that the slums of Yankeedom has ever produced. But even poor old Malcolm X, he has to move over also, because today in America, our politically correct heroes are growing. Yeah, they're just growing faster than we can point to them. Every time some athlete, some real big athlete with all the prowess of his sport, every time he comes down with the AIDS virus, guess what? He becomes a national hero. Notice it. As soon as one of these people gets the AIDS virus, before their temperature can go up there at the White House, being greeted by the president and his wife. Watch out, Hillary. You know, what's wrong with our society? One of our heroes, this was a basketball player. He bragged about having over 10,000 sexual contacts before he finally got AIDS. Today in America, it seems the only way that you can really be a man is to have at least 1,000 sexual contacts. If that's the earmark, if that's the earmark of being a real man, ladies and gentlemen, every dog in Mississippi is a man. We are better than that. This is not what the Lord intended for His people. We will be judged if we do not speak out about this. Our Confederate forefathers would have been appalled to know that such was going on in their country, in their land. And I know you are too. But these are not the heroes that we are here to here to praise. We are here to honor men such as Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson. These men are men that you can tell stories about. And I have several stories that I like to relate to you about these men, Lee and Jackson. Something about their nature, and this is why I said a while ago that heroes are those who really protect the cultural environment or the cultural continuum of a society, because these are the stories that we pass on from father to son, from mother to daughter, from generation to generation. And these little stories, each of them will have a little gem of truth that you can apply to your life and help you lead and point your life in the right direction. General Robert E. Lee was said to be a man of humility. He was a very humble individual. As a matter of fact, Lee said, a man of true humility is humble by the act of correcting another. Now get that. Lee said that if you are a man of true humility and you come in contact with an individual that needed correcting, that you are very humbled by the process of correcting that individual. You're not haughty. You don't hold it over them. You don't lord it over them and say, look, my friend, let me tell you how it is. I know what's right and you're dumb. No, you're humbled by the process. That's the type of man that Lee was. There was a story told about General Lee. And one thing that I can identify with General Lee is that he was a very humble man, but he did have a temper. You push him too far, you say the wrong thing at the wrong time, he would bark at you pretty sternly, although if he ever did, he always apologized and made amends. I can identify with that, folks, because I barked at people before. And if I ever bark at you and I come back the next day and I apologize, take me at my word. I'm serious, because it hurts. It hurts when you go away knowing that you hurt a friend's feeling. And I know Robert E. Lee felt the same way. One day, General Lee was in his camp talking to his fellow officers, commanders of the various corps commanders, and a young major came rushing up to Lee with an urgent dispatch from another general. And he opened the dispatch up and in front of all the officers read the whole dispatch to General Lee. Well, General Lee understood. In the Army, in the military, you don't want all your information scattered about everybody knowing what's going on, because this would give away to the enemy all your plans. So General Lee was rather upset that this individual would do that, so he called the major into his tent, and General Lee rebuked the man, rather sternly rebuked him. And the man became very insulted and just saluted and left in a huff. But General Lee at that point understood, I've hurt this man's feelings. He didn't intend to hurt the man, so he intended to make the man understand military propriety, what should and should not be done. So General Lee made it a point that afternoon, when General Lee habitually would have a little snack in his tent, he called for this major to come and imbibe in some buttermilk. General Lee loved buttermilk, and he offered the major buttermilk and tried to make amends with the major, but the major was in a huff. He grabbed his buttermilk, drank it, and laid it down, saluted, said, yes, sir, and turned and marched out, stormed out, still in a huff. General Lee understood this man was still very upset and angry. Now, if it had been me, I would probably take my shoe off and hit the sucker going out the tent, you know. There goes my temper, but General Lee didn't do that. He did not do that. He let the man go. Later that afternoon, General Lee was making his rounds of his camp, and in the presence of his staff officer, one of which was this young major, and they was down inspecting some lines, and the major didn't have anything to do, so he leaned up against a tree and went to sleep. As he went to sleep, a cloud came up, and a rain started falling. General Lee found the major laying under the tree, and it was beginning to rain, and instead of waking him up and disturbing him, General Lee took his cloak off, spread it over the major, and then went on back to his camp. Well, when the major woke up, he realized what General Lee had done. General Lee had provided for his comfort, the major's comfort, at General Lee's own discomfort, even though the major had treated Lee in such a manner. The major said he was never in his life taught such a lesson of humility. But this was the type of man that General Lee was. General Lee was a man of courage. He was a courageous man. He was the type of general that led at the front of the lines. He would want to be out there where the action was. Very often, you know, you've heard the stories of the Texas and the different brigades that would shout, Lee to the rear, Lee to the rear. In many cases, they refused to move. No matter what order General Lee would give, they would refuse to move until their beloved general was safe in the rear of the lines. But General Lee was not habitually a shirker of his responsibility. He did not always seek the rear of the lines for safety. He was out front. He believed that any good general led from the front and not from the rear. But General Lee said that obviously all his generals didn't feel that way. He loved to tell this story once while he was in camp. He was in his camp during a lull in a battle. He said a black gentleman came up to him and wanted to meet General Lee. And General Lee introduced himself, said, I am General Lee. What can I do for you? And the black gentleman said, well, Well, I'm a soldier, and I just wanted to meet you. I heard so much about you, but I just wanted to meet you. And General Lee said, well, that's very interesting, my man. I said, what kind of soldier are you? Are you one of ours or one of theirs? My son, Mr. General, I'm one of your soldiers. I'm a Confederate soldier. And General Lee said, well, that's interesting. You know, most of my men get shot at, and most of my soldiers have been shot, and you don't appear to have been shot. I don't see how you could be one of my soldiers. And the black gentleman said, No, sir, General, you see, I stays in the back of the army where the generals are. I stay safe. So obviously General Lee said not all his generals were quite as courageous as they should have been, but that was the type of man that Lee was. He led from the front. He was a man that inspired the dedication of his men. Probably no other general in modern warfare has ever inspired men like Robert E. Lee inspired men. He inspired them not through his voice, not through his eloquence of command. He inspired them because he was an humble man who always consistently looked after their best interests and did all that he could in the defense of his country. And these men respected that. General Jackson is another man that we're here to honor tonight. Now, many people think of General Jackson as a very stern type of man, but General Jackson was also a man that loved people. We've already heard a little bit about how General Jackson paid for the support of a black Sunday school. Indeed, all throughout the war, when he received his paycheck, he would take a tithe from that paycheck and send back to his wife in Lexington for her to disperse to the black Sunday school there that he himself had personally helped to found there in Lexington. And to this very day, you can go to Lexington and see in the chapel there that black church, a small Confederate flag in a window, in the stained glass window with Stonewall Jackson Memorial there. Jackson loved people, and he loved black people, he loved white people. He was not one of these races we've heard so much about that people would like to think that we are all about. But that was the type of man. Was another interesting thing, everybody knows that Jackson, I believe everybody has heard that Jackson loved lemons. Have y'all heard that? Well, did you know he also liked persimmons? He really liked persimmons. That story was told about Jackson one day in the fall. He was riding out to view his army on the march, and he ran across right under a persimmon tree. Well, the branches in the persimmon tree was up so high that he could not reach a branch or any persimmon, so he had his horse walk right under the persimmon tree. He stood up in the saddle and grabbed a branch and pulled himself up in the persimmon tree and proceeded to eat persimmons like a coon, I suppose. He just going just eating persimmons. Well, his horse, naturally grazing around, grazed off over the hill. Jackson is stuck up in the persimmon tree after he ate his crawl full of persimmons, and he looked around, no way to get down. His men were coming marching by, and so Jackson had to hail his men to come over, try to help him get down. The only problem was, there was nobody with horses. Everybody was on foot, and they could barely touch, they couldn't touch the limb either. So finally, they finally found some fence rails. They made a little skid that held up to the top limb that Jackson skidded down the persimmon tree. And of course, the story was passed from one brigade to the next, and the story was laughed about. Did you know that such and such company probably killed or probably treed the biggest coon in Virginia? And of course, another company said, well, not only was he the biggest coon, that was the ugliest coon we ever saw. So that was a story that was passed around about Jackson. Another thing we were talking here a few minutes ago about the Louisiana troops, Richard Taylor's troop in Jackson's army. And if you know anything about Lee's Tigers, there was actually Richard Taylor's group. That was probably some of the most vulgar, outspoken men from the waterfronts and docks of New Orleans. They were just horrendous people. Matter of fact, the Confederate soldiers in North Louisiana would hardly have anything to do with them. And basically, the soldiers that Taylor had in his army were from South Louisiana. And when Taylor joined Jackson in the valley, Jackson noticed that as soon as Taylor's army halted, the men broke out banjos and started dancing and just coming up with whiskey and everything else, you know, and Jackson just looked at Taylor, and he doubted the suitability of such men for battle, whereupon Dick Taylor told General Jackson, because these were mostly French people that he had there, and they were speaking in French, he said, "General, let me assure you that men such as this have kissed more women and defeated more armies in Europe than anyone you'll ever see." And indeed, these men became known as Lee's Tigers after they were put back in the Army of Northern Virginia, and they were indeed really staunch fighters. But it will also be noted that General Jackson had a very calming effect on these people, and he really, his religion did not take a back seat, and Jackson really influenced these men. One thing that I really like about Jackson, a story that I heard, R.L. Dabney, who I'm sure you all are familiar with, stated in his book that about a week or two before Chancellorsville, he and General Jackson were going to church one Sunday, and Jackson was talking to Dr. Dabney and said that it looked like things were really turning bad for the South, and a pause in the conversation proceeded, and then General Jackson turned to Dr. Dabney and said, "I hope that I do not outlive the independence of my country." About a week later, General Jackson, or 2 weeks later, General Jackson was dead. And it shows the feeling that Jackson had for our heritage, for our history, and for our people, and the utter belief and love that he had for our cause. He would rather die than to see the independence of the Confederate States of America lost. So I'm very impressed by these men, these heroes as they were. But you know, there's a certain characteristics about heroes, and I'm not going to list all tonight, but I've distilled them down to three characteristics that I think that General Jackson and General Lee display in their lives. One thing is they're humble people. They're very humble, both Lee and Jackson. Everything that they did, every success that they would have, they would give God the credit for the achievements in their life and on the battlefield. They understood that we, in and of ourselves, people, we can do nothing. If we depend upon our own wisdom and our own reason and our own intellect, we're depending upon shallow intellect indeed. They understood this. And that understanding that you and I, as individuals, we have within us a nature that is unlike what is the Heavenly Father would like to see in us, that this nature needs to be cleaned and removed from our lives in order for us to be the people that we should be. When we understand that, there's nothing that you and I can do to change that, but only dependent upon God's sovereign grace, only then can you understand why men like Lee and Jackson were humble. Because this is an humbling experience. When you come to this point in your life, you become truly humble individuals. You know that you are dependent not on what you can do, but on what God's grace can do for you. And that's what Lee and Jackson, that's why they had that such strong feeling and strong dedication to humility. They also, great people, great heroes, people who would be heroes, have a great respect for God's law. They understand that within man is this sinful nature, and that all that we do is tainted by that sin, and that unless we get rid of that nature, that nothing that we do will be in a positive manner. To understand God's law is to understand the fact that nothing that we do is worthy of preservation outside of the will of God. I think it was Richard Weaver in his book, The Southern Tradition at Bay, made the point that the first art of civilization is learning self-control. You know, before you can be a civilized human being, you've got to learn how to control yourself. But you see, look back in Genesis account. Look back there. What happened to man? Man didn't want to control himself. Man wanted to do what man wanted to do. Because after all, if they do these things which that serpent said, they could be as God. So man wanted to do man's will. But what General Lee and General Jackson teaches us is that we've got to learn self-control. If you don't have self-control, you do not have a civilization. Think about that. What's the difference between a civilized society and a barbaric society? In a civilized society, we control our will. Understanding, and General Lee and Jackson understood that you and I cannot control our will within ourselves. We've got to surrender to God's will, and through His grace, self will come under control. Why is it that you probably go home tonight and you'll go into your house and you'll lock your door about three times? More than likely, if you're like me, you'll sleep next to a pistol in case someone breaks into your house. I drove over here, I don't know if John knew it, but the whole time I was sitting on a 357 Magnum right under my seat. No, I'm not a mean man. Why do I have all these guns? Why do I have three locks on my door at my house? Why do I lock my vehicle every time I get out of it? Why do these ladies have to fear when they go out at night? Why do you have so much murder going on in society today? Why? Because we have lost self-control, self-will. Man has determined whatever he decides to do, that is right. Ladies and gentlemen, what I'm telling you is we are becoming less of a civilized society. We are becoming a barbaric society. We have got to learn to respect God's law. And another thing, heroes, people like Lee and Jackson, another one of their characteristics is they understand the nature and responsibility of doing one's duty. You know, sometimes, you know, we say, oh, well, I will do my duty. But remember, folks, duty sometimes is not the nicest thing to be done. You know, I love the expression that Benjamin Franklin used to say that honesty is the best policy. Bunk. That's not true. Because there will be times when honesty is not a good policy, because honesty is not a policy at all. Honesty is a principle. Honesty is the best principle. You stick to your principles, good or bad. The three Egyptian children, as they stood before that fiery furnace, you know, the best policy would have been to say, okay, king, I'll bow down to you. But they didn't believe like our politicians believe today. They didn't believe in doing what was expedient or what was easy. They believed in principle. And they said, what did they say? I love these three Hebrew children. I love them, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. I love what they said to the king. They said, okay, Nebuchadnezzar, fire the furnace up three times hotter than you have it. So we believe that our God, if you throw us in there, that our God will go with us. But what else did they say? See, that's good policy. But what else did they say? But even if he chooses not to be in there, we still will not bow to you. Hey, what is that? That's making principle your life. You're guiding your footsteps by principle and not what is expedient, as in policy making. You and I must also have that same attitude. No matter what the liberal, politically acceptable establishment says to you and I, no matter what they tell us, no matter how many defeats they hand us, we still will not surrender. We stick by principle. We don't operate on a system of majority rule, a show of hands, who's in favor of the Confederate flag. Well, we're in the minority, so we quit. We are here on principle, and we're guided by principle. And as long as you're guided by principle, you're on solid, safe, and secure ground. Robert E. Lee knew what duty was about. He wrote to his son these words, "Duty, then, is the most sublime word in the English language. Do your duty in all things. You cannot do more once you never wish to do less. Do your duty. Your duty." Sometimes your duty will call you to do those things which may turn out a failure. And Robert E. Lee knew this in his life after Appomattox. He made this statement. Someone was asking him, you know, well, it looks like we lost the war. It's over now, you know. Do you think we did the wise thing? You know, was it the expedient thing to do? You know, here's what General Lee said. We could have pursued no other course without dishonor. Talking about secession and defending the Confederate cause. We could pursue no other course without dishonor. And sad as these results have been, if it had all to be done over again, we should be compelled to act in precisely the same manner. Now think about that. After realizing and knowing all that he knew that had happened through that war, General Lee said, even yet, if compelled to do it all over again, we would do it because it's our duty to stand up for the right and good and moral and ethical principles in your life. Now, these men that we tonight are honoring, these men that we are tonight honoring, are not honored throughout the world. They're certainly not even honored throughout this country. If you'll remember back in the late 60s, early 70s, a guy who is absolutely no relationship of mine, Ted Kennedy, stood up in the U.S. Senate and condemned Robert E. Lee as a traitor. Said that Robert E. Lee was a traitor. Charles Francis Adams, in 1907, at Washington Lee University, was given a talk on Lee, and Charles Francis Adams was the president of the Massachusetts Historical Society and the grandson of President John Quincy Adams. And Charles Francis Adams said, men from my area of the country do not see Lee as you do. They see him basically as a traitor. In 1870, right after Lee's death, there was a push going on in the U.S. Senate to return some of Lee's valuables that had been stolen from Arlington during the war. And one of the radicals stood up in Congress and said that he could care nothing for returning anything to that traitor Lee. That far as he was concerned, Lee was a vile traitor, as vile as any man who had dipped his hands into his country's blood. You know, we honor these people, but they don't honor it. They refer to Lee and Jackson, and not just Lee and Jackson, but you and I, because we honor Jackson and our ancestors who were Confederates. They refer to them and to us as traitors. Now, that's interesting. Secession is treason? Well, what about secession? Is it treason? Of course, we can run through a litany of reasons to point out that it were not. The colonies, 13 original colonies that seceded from England, was it treason for them to do that? Of course not. The Articles of Confederation were seceded from by 9 states in order to form the Union under the Constitution. Were those men, those 9 states, were they ever charged with treason? Josiah Quincy, in 1803, first spoke of secession in the halls of Congress. And it's interesting, as somebody from Mississippi who now resides in Louisiana, you know what Josiah Quincy was complaining about? Well, at that time, they were talking about bringing Louisiana into the Union. Josiah Quincy said that his honorable state of Massachusetts would rather secede from the Union than to live in a Union amongst those mixed creed Creoles from Louisiana. Kind of racist remark, I would say. And, of course, we know about the Hartford Convention in 1815. The war was going very poorly for New England, and they decided, you know, it's time to get out. It's interesting that the North is always eager to get into wars and eager for Southerners to fight wars, but if it's economically hard on them, they always beat the rally call for surrender, and they literally did that. Texas seceded from Mexico, and Texas was allowed into the Union after it had seceded from Mexico, and an argument can be made that had it not been for the help that Texas received from the United States and the United States government, Texas would have never been able to secede from Mexico. But yet, no one ever accused the Texans of being traitors because they withdrew from or seceded from Mexico. After the War for Southern Independence in 1903, I believe it was, the United States government actually became involved in the secession of Panama from Colombia. Did you know that? We needed a canal treaty with Colombia that owned Panama at that time. Colombia said, no, we will not give it to you. The United States said, well, that's no big deal. We know about secession movements. And they funded the Panamanians in their secession movement. As soon as Panama seceded from Colombia, the United States recognized that, sent gunboats in there to protect them, and signed a treaty with them. Treason. That's not treason, they said. That's good policy. The only time the Yankees have ever complained about secession was in 1861, and then they labeled it as treason. somewhere along the road in the defense of the Southern Officer Corps and the people of the South, our people have come up with a unique argument that secession was not treason. Now, there are many, and I said I just quickly ran over, and we could spend all night talking about each one of those points as a point of fact that secession was not treason or is not treason. But I want to look right briefly with you at a unique book that was written in 1825 entitled Rawls' View of the Constitution of the United States. Actually, Views of the Constitution of the United States, written by William Rawls. Now, the interesting thing about this book is that it was used at West Point as a textbook. And guess what? This book taught that secession was a right, a natural, organic right of the state. Now, I want to talk to you just a little bit about that. You know, it's interesting, in the arsenal of the propagandists, no word weapon is so good as a weapon that acts like a tar brush. You know what? You know, if I threw a tar brush over there at old Carl Ford, you know, even if it didn't hit him real good, just by glancing on him, it'd stick on him and make a big mess. You know, so there are certain words that are like tar brushes. You know, racist. You know, if someone pointed to you and said racist, you know, that's all they have to say, and you're labeled as an evil individual, and it'd take you all day to explain, well, I'm not a racist. But yet, it's a word that gets thrown out like a hand grenade, and it just scatters everywhere. Well, the word treason is just such a word, just such a tar brush. And the people of the North realized early on that if they could brand these Southerners as traitors, people would look at them in such a way that they would not give them the respect and certainly not the recognition that they needed. But, as I said, a very interesting book was found, and a very interesting story has been told about this book, William Rawls' book, A View of the Constitution. Listen to what William Rawls' grandson said about this book and General Lee and the teaching at West Point. He said, quote, General Lee told Bishop Wilmer of Louisiana. Now, Bishop Wilmer was the Episcopal minister of Louisiana that was really the religious confidant of General Lee. It was in Virginia before the war. General Lee told Bishop Wilmer of Louisiana that if it had not been for the instruction he got from Rawls' textbook at West Point, he would not have left the old army and joined the South at the breakout of the late war. Now, that's a pretty strong indictment of the North, because it's saying that here at West Point, these Confederate officers are being taught something that 10, 15, 20 years later, you're shooting at them for enforcing what you had taught them 20 years prior. So it's a stern indictment, and the North has really drawn back and reeled back and really said, egad, you know, we can't have this, you know, that's not right. And they really, really tried to hush this up. And matter of fact, if you try to find a copy of this book today, it is virtually impossible. It's a long story about how I finally got a hold of a copy, but I went literally round by the proverbial Laura's house to get it, but I've got a copy on microfiche anyway. First, let's talk about who is this guy, William Rawls. And this is an interesting story in itself. William Rawls was born somewhere around 1759. His parents were loyalists during the Revolutionary War, and when the war broke out and started going a little bad for the English, he and his family fled to London, where he stayed until the war was over and it became obvious that the United States had won its independence. And Rawls applied for a passport to come back to the United States, and that passport was signed by Benjamin Franklin. He came back to Philadelphia, shucked himself of all the anti-Republican ideas, and became a strong advocate of Republican, I'm using that in a little R now, Republican government, and started studying law and became a very prominent lawyer in Philadelphia. He became a lawyer. He became a friend of Benjamin Franklin and George Washington. George Washington was a personal friend of his. When Washington's government was formed, General Washington appointed William Rawls as an attorney general for the Philadelphia, Pennsylvania district. William Rawls later joined and became president of an abolitionist society. And then in 1825, he wrote and published his now famous book, Views of the Constitution, which is approximately a 250-260 page book composed of approximately 31 chapters. Now, the interesting thing about this book is that here we have a Northerner, a Yankee, a man who's a close associate of Benjamin Franklin and George Washington, a man who is an avowed abolitionist, who's writing a textbook on the Constitution, really one of the first real textbooks on the Constitution, that's talking about, in one of the chapters, entitled The Permanency of the Union, which is chapter 31 in his first edition, talks about how a state is to secede from the Union. Listen to what he has to say about secession from... another thing I didn't mention, right the year after Rawls' book was published, it was reviewed by the North American Journal, the North American Review. It was a journal, Boston Journal, and this book was really the journal that was taken by the American intelligentsia. If you were anyone in America in the intelligentsia at that time, you subscribed to the North American Review. And in this review, the guy from Boston, Massachusetts is reviewing this book. He goes through the whole book, and he only has one little negative comment about the book, and it's about how Rawls views the election of the president. He does say not one word about Rawls' views on secession. Now, that ought to make you stop and wonder, folks. This is 1825. The journal of American political intelligentsia is reviewing Rawls' book, and secession is talked about in a whole chapter. I've read the whole book, including that last chapter. It's a whole chapter filled with how a state is to go about seceding from the Union and the rights of a state to secede. But yet this Boston Journal said absolutely nothing about secession. You would think, by the way Ken Burns and that motley crowd of liberals talk about secession, that these people in Boston will raise Cain. Say, man, you're a fool. States can't secede. That's treason. But they said not one word about it. I mean, hey, what's going on here? I tell you what's going on. In 1825, it was a given. It was a natural stated assumption among all the states that we had freely acceded into the Union. If our states choose to withdraw, we have that right. You see, secession and states' rights is not a Southern issue, people. It's an American issue. It's an issue that is ingrained within our political system. And it belongs to the North as well as the South. The only difference is the North turned against American principle. The Southerners stuck by American principle. And who are traitors? Traitors are those who turn against their principles. I'd pick up that term treason and hurl it back at the Yankees. You're the traitor. You turn your back on real America. So, interesting, anytime you get in an argument or a discussion, we don't argue, do we? I argue, y'all discuss. Anytime we get in a discussion with these people and they say, well, you know, that's treason, you just...
Can I pull that paper back, please?
Yes. Is that all right? Okay. Anytime you start talking to these people, question them about, well, why was secession considered such a natural act? And another interesting thing... Are we attached here? another interesting story about this book, Rawls' View of the Constitution. 8 years before South Carolina seceded from the Union, a man by the name of Francis Leiber wrote a book on civil government and civil liberties, on self-government and civil liberties, in which he highly recommends Rawls' book for anyone who wants to learn about American civil government. He says, this is the book you need to look to. Now, if you remember, if that name Francis Leiber means anything to you, he was a man who codified the rules of warfare for the Union Army, which they never read, obviously. But anyway, that he was a very famous, I believe he taught at Columbia, a very famous lawyer and educator. And he, in 1850, said, 53, said, this book, Rawls' book, is a good book. You ought to read it. Now, if secession was wrong in 1853, why did this man tell his students and former students, read Rawls, it's a good book? Well, obviously, he didn't say that because everyone considered at that time it to be legal. The Boston The North American Review in Boston, in its summation of Rawls's work, made this statement, and this is in their summation. He said, to those who want to read this book, to those who are desirous of studying the noblest monument of human wisdom, the Constitution of the United States, we recommend the treatises of Mr. Rawls as a safe and intelligent guide. A safe and intelligent guide. That's what the people in Boston, Massachusetts said in 1826. So, we have to look. Why? What has happened in America when, in the beginning, we all accepted secession as a natural right? And why was it that we accepted this? In his first chapter of his book, Rawls talks about the foundation of America. Where did America come from? Where did the United States? How did we come together? How did we come to be a nation? And he lays down this principle, a moral power equal to and of the same nature that which made alone can destroy. Now, Rawls said that a government is made by certain entities or certain peoples, and those entities or people have the right to destroy it. That's a basic principle. Then he goes on to say, now, who made the government in the United States? And listen to what Rawls says. He said, it, the ratification of the Constitution, was not the simple act of a homogeneous body of men, either large or small. It was the act of many independent states. It was to be the act of the people of each state and not of the people at large. You know, old Story and Webster and Lincoln said that the Constitution was ratified by, quote, the people in the aggregate. But that's not what Rawls said. He said, that's the dumbest thing I'd ever heard of, he said. You know, everybody knows that the states ratified the Constitution. If the states made the Constitution, then who has the right to unmake it? The states. And each state, according to Rawls and according to American history, and you all know this as well as I do, no doubt, that each state acted under its own volition, and it was empowered to act for its people in its states and no one else, and no one else had authority over them. So when Virginia decided to accede into the Union, a convention of its people met and voted to go into the Union. But it was that convention was binding only on the people of Virginia. That's why Rhode Island and North Carolina stayed out for a year and a half, and they were treated as foreign powers because they could not be coerced into the Union. Although at that time there were 11 states in the Union, those 11 did not have the power to force little old Rhode Island, which is not much bigger than this county, really. They could not force Rhode Island into that Union. Why not? Because Rhode Island was a sovereign state. It had the right to judge for itself when it would go into the Union. And according to the principles that Rawls had laid down that was American principles, only the state could decide how long it was going to stay in or if it were to come out of the Union. It was not treason. This is a natural right of government. We call it government by the consent of those governed. This is an America, fundamental American principle, but it's a noble principle that has many antecedents. It goes back a long ways. In 1579, the French Huguenots wrote a treatise called Vindicae Contra Tyrannis. In this document, they laid down a principle in government that stated that kings, and here king is being used as a metaphor for government, said that they, kings or government, should acknowledge that for them, they, as it were, barred their power and authority. With Vindicae Contra Tyrannis, these French Huguenots were speaking out against the tyrannical rule of absolutism in France, and they said, look, king, God did not make people for you. You are made to serve the people under God's will and God's law. And when you, Mr. King, when you run counter to God's will and God's law, we, the people, have the right to pull you down. Hey, that's a revolutionary idea. But the people in France, the Huguenots in France in 1579 1579, clearly enunciated that doctrine. John Milton, during the revolution in France, in England, John Milton stated that the power of kings and magistrates is nothing else but that which is derivated, transferred, and committed to them in trust, the right remaining in the people to resume it to themselves if by kings and magistrates it be abused. John Milton said, in essence, that, Mr. King, if you do not do as you are told to do, or have we have compacted a covenant with you to do, we will pull you down off that throne. And John Milton even goes on to say that the king stood in mortal death, in mortal threat of his death, of his life and death, if he did not obey the sovereign rule of God and God's law. Samuel Rutherford, a Scotchman, in 1664, said that the estates, now the estates is what we would call the state, but the estates that made the king of Scotland king, they had the right to unmake that king if that king ran counter to the law that the people understood. Rutherford stated, those who had the power to make have the power to unmake a king. Now, what does this have to do with America? All these are precedents, are antecedent precedents to our idea that government exists by the consent of those governed. But that consent is given through the act of the estates or states. Our states got together and formed the Union. The federal government never existed at all. The compact of the states to form the Union existed between the 13 states. It was not between the states and the federal government, but between the states. They made a compact to make a government. And they said, this government will exist, and we consent to live on this government. We delegate certain rights, and this is what we delegate. But it's a bargain, and it has to be kept. You have to keep your part, we'll keep our part. And that was the nature of government that they wanted to live under. Rawl, in his book, A View of the Constitution, goes on to state that the Constitution was actually put in power in order to protect and defend the rights of the states. That the Constitution was there not to empower the federal government, but to give the federal government certain delegated authority and to preserve for the states all residue of authority. In its final chapter, Rawl goes on in many places to talk about the principle of secession. Rawl said in his final chapter, we shall conclude with adverting to the principle of its cohesion, the cohesion of the Union, and to the provision it contained for its own duration and extension. He talks about then that the states had the right to withdraw. He said, it depends on the state itself whether it will continue a member of the Union. Now, think about this. We got students here at West Point reading this textbook here. It says, now what he's saying now? Wait a minute, look at it. It depends on the state itself whether it shall continue a member in the Union. Now, can you blame these guys if they're at West Point and being taught this, and then 20 years later they go to Manassas and say, hey, we're going to defend our state. We've withdrawn from the Union. We're not traitors. We're upholding constitutional principles. But that's exactly what happened. That is what has happened to our southern ancestors. They've been accused of being traitors to America when they were doing nothing more than upholding constitutional principles. Listen to what Rawl has to say about secession. That to deny this right, the right of secession from the Union, to deny this right would be inconsistent with the principle on which our political systems are founded, which is that the people have, in all cases, a right to determine how they will be governed. Now, people, I could go on here all night quoting you passage after passage from this textbook that was used at West Point showing that secession was a constitutional right. Now, how long was this book used? I want to just kind of give you a general idea. Now, this book, many people have argued it was used for 40 years, it was used for 2 years, it was used not at all. In my research, I determined that it was used at least 1 year as a textbook at West Point, and from that time until just before the war, it was used as a reference book. And as a matter of fact, Jefferson Davis, Robert E. Lee, General Joseph Johnson, and I've got a list here, we don't have time. They all attested to the fact that at West Point they were very familiar with this book, Rawls' book. The Adjutant General, I believe it was, let me get this right quick, of the United States, Colonel Edgar Dudley, Judge Advocate of the United States Army in 1909, looked into this matter because so many people had been talking about this. And this is just a capsulation of his report dealing with Rawl's view as it was used at West Point. He said, the result of this examination, this is a Yankee now making this report, so he's not going to be favorable to us unless he can help it. The result of this examination of the records of the United States Military Academy and of the view of the statements on both sides of the subject shows conclusively to my mind that Rawls's work, A View of the Constitution of the United States, was introduced as a textbook by the professor of geology, history, and ethics in 1826. And then he goes on to talk about how it was used in reference and how many students had used it in debates and how the debates over nullification and secession at West Point had continued for years and how it was used, and most students were very aware of it. And this guy, the judge advocate of the United States Army, even admitted that many Southern students, and he said no doubt many Northern students also accepted the idea that a state had a right to secede from the Union. Now, what does this have to do with us today? I think that you and I, we need to understand better that the idea of self-determination, the right of a people to judge for themselves how they shall be governed, is an inalienable American idea and principle. It is not something that goes away. Tyrants can suppress rights, but they do not destroy rights. Tyrants can suppress liberty, but they do not destroy liberty. It is your job and my job to see to it that the future generation of Southerners and Americans understand what it truly means to be an American citizen. The truest essence of American citizenship is that you and I, acting through our states, have a right to consent to the government that exists over us. Now, if you have a right to consent, you cannot have a right to consent unless you have a right to unconsent. So we, the people of the sovereign states, we are the ones who judge if the federal government is operating under legitimate powers or not. This is true for the cadets at West Point, and this is true for us today. I want you to leave here. One point I want you to try to get across is that the most shocking and damning information that I have offered here tonight is not that Rawls's book that taught that secession was legal was used at West Point for 1 or 2 years. That is not the most damning information. The information that is the most potent and the most damaging to the enemy is the fact that this book, which was used at West Point, taught that secession was legitimate. This book was recognized by the North as well as the South as a legitimate book, and the rights and the principles that it taught were honorable principles. So that gets us back to General Lee and General Jackson and our Confederate ancestors. If they struggle for noble principles, constitutional principles, how can they be damned as traitors? Well, they cannot. They're not traitors. What are they? They are heroes. They are heroes to the true constitutional republic that our forefathers in 1776 struggled to establish. You and I are descendants of those people. You and I are descendants of Confederate forefathers who in 1861 only did what their forefathers in 1776 had done, that is to struggle for the rights of self-government. That is an honorable cause. Appomattox did not destroy principles. Certainly the South is back in the Union. We were literally bayoneted back into the Union. Certainly I'm not here advocating secession today, but I'm telling you people, secession, the right of self-determination, is an unalienable right of every American as declared in the Declaration of Independence and is codified in the Constitution of the United States of America. It is right, it is honorable, it is legal. Now, true, tyrants do not allow you to exercise your rights, but tyrants do not destroy rights. It is your job, it is my job, to educate every generation that comes after us what is the right and honorable course to be done, to be carried out and pursued. To teach them that our forefathers were honorable men. Certainly not all of them were honorable. They were fallen men, just like all of us, but they strove after right principles. It should be the enemy, the invader, the plunderer, the raper, the despoiler. He's the one that should have to prove why he was down here doing what he was doing. If a man breaks into my house and threatens my wife and assaults my daughter, and I shoot that sucker, should I have to explain why I did that to a fiend? Of course not. I'm defending my home, my people, my property. Your ancestors likewise did nothing more than I would do or you would do in a case of your house being broken into by some thing. You would come to their defense. And honorably did our forefathers defend the right. It is left to you and I to continue that struggle. That struggle has not ended. The war for Southern independence was not a war that was lost. It was merely a battle in a great war between goodness and evil, lightness and dark. There are those who are from the school of rationalism, those who think that men are so wise and so brilliant that they can collectively come together and think and figure out all the problems in the world and that we don't need God. Those people are the ones that our forefathers were fighting. Because those people are the ones who took over the North after somewhere around 1830 and literally turned the North around from the true principles of the gospel of the Lord. And those people are the ones that we're fighting even to this day. And it's not just in America, it's throughout the world. It is the old story of the Garden of Eden where Satan tells man, you know, you are really a smart creature and you can figure out right and wrong. Just take this fruit. You don't need God. But see, our forefathers knew better. They knew that man is a fallen creature and that man must have God. Guided by God's will, we can overcome many obstacles. And yes, there are dark days now and there will be dark days in the future. But people, I tell you, I believe in that slogan that's on the that motto on the great seal of the Confederacy, Deo Vindici, God will vindicate. In the end, we are on the right side because we stand forthright for righteousness. We will have the victory eventually. Don't surrender to the enemy. Dr. Dabney loved to tell a story after the war. When he was in Richmond, they was unveiling a monument to General Stonewall Jackson. And he talked about how they had a gigantic parade, and all the dignitaries came out, and the dignitaries of the city and of the state were at the head of this long parade, and how all the citizens in Richmond were out and waving. The ladies were waving the handkerchiefs, the children, the men were waving and shouting as the dignitaries came by. He said, then a little bit later on, the general and the general staff and officers such as Dabney came by, and he felt certainly the crowd will roar for us because, you know, we stood and basked in the presence of General Jackson. Certainly the crowd will shout for us. And he said, indeed, the crowd did shout for them. He said, but then the largest shout and the most continuous praise was heard from a long, tattered line of bent old men who were the last remnant of the Jackson Stonewall Brigade. He said they were leaning upon canes because legs had been blown off. He said empty sleeves were flopping in the breeze because arms had been blown off. Old men that had to be led along by other men because their eyes were gone and they were feeble from wounds of battle. These people, the last remnant of the Stonewall Brigade, he said that was when the crowd went crazy. He said he thought in his heart, there is life yet in the old state. He said, yes, indeed, there are still those who care and who will pursue right, honor, and virtue. I heard it when they shouted for those old men. He said, I really appreciate that. The next day, at a gathering, I believe it was the gentleman that wrote Christ in the Camp, told General Jackson, said, I agree with what you said, General Jackson. I was moved and honored to be in there and to hear that. He said, but I'm going to disagree with you on one thing. He said, Dr. Dabney, the biggest and longest and continuous shout went up when we unveiled Jackson's monument. And the people there hailed Jackson's little daughter, who was a mere infant when her father was slain and martyred there at Chancellorsville. They hailed that little girl up to that monument. And as she touched that monument, he said, remember it, Dr. Dabney, that's when the crowd went crazy. He said, think about it. The old must teach the new, and the new must be held up by the present generation in order that we can continue those things that we know to be true and noble and honor. That's what we are doing here today. We are holding up We are holding up the young generation up to that statue of Lee Jackson and pointing them onward to the way. And that should catch our impulse. That should make our heart beat harder. That should make us strive on in days of darkness. And ladies and gentlemen, I know we have seen some battles. We've seen some ups and downs. Here in the last couple of weeks, I've had some very good reports on the battle over in Georgia. And it looks good. Very good. But our enemy is not going to run away. Our enemy is still there. They will not be satisfied until that flag is no more. They will not be satisfied until every Confederate monument has been removed, until everyone is ashamed to speak in a Southern accent. They will not be satisfied until the whole world believes that all of you in here are a motley crowd of ignorant redneck racists. They will not stop. Don't let down the defense. Move forward. Advance toward the sound of the gun. Give them no quarter, for I assure you they will give you none. Don't be lulled into complacency by someone who tells you, well, let's compromise. There is no compromise with that type of evil. It's either fight and win or be utterly destroyed. And if I have my choice, I would rather be destroyed than to live in a type of land that they want to prepare for our future generations. It is your job, it is your responsibility, it is my job, it is my responsibility to continue the struggle. Let us hold up that young generation to the men of the likeness of Lee and Jackson. Let us always inculcate within our children the true spirit of the Old South. Teach them love, teach them humility, teach them to adore the land that we adore, and pray with me as we pray the prayer, the South. The South, the grand, the glorious, the everlasting South. God save the South. Thank you.